happens when an electric vehicle battery can no longer power a car efficiently? Most people see waste. Nick Nesbitt, founder of Mapleview Energy, sees untapped potential sitting in a growing waste stream. While the rest of the world races to mine more lithium, Nick is mining our garages. He's on a mission to repurpose Second Life EV batteries, the ones no longer fit for the road, into commercial-scale energy storage systems. These aren't just leftovers, they're powerful building blocks for a grid that's smarter, cheaper, and more reliable. By 2030, we'll have 1,000 gigawatt hours of retired EV batteries. That's enough to power entire cities, if we know how to capture it.
Let's go. Let's start this business and try to build a company that focuses on repurposing electric vehicle batteries into stationary energy storage for commercial and industrial businesses.
In this episode, I sit down with Nick to unpack what it really takes to launch a climate tech startup from scratch. From moving back home, to create his own runway, to navigating accelerators, to experiencing the roller coaster of setbacks and breakthroughs. This is a story about seeing abundance where others see waste and having the courage to act on it.
What everybody is seeing, right, is that our electricity costs are going to continue to increase as we use more electricity. And by being able to do some, you know, peak shaving and cutting the demand charge, there's, you know, a really good ROI for adopting energy storage.
Welcome to the Capitalist Hippie, the podcast where we challenge the old rules of business to build something better. I'm Marco Pimentel, marketing expert, entrepreneur, and lover of bold, sustainable ideas. Every week, we dive into data-backed insights, groundbreaking ideas, and real-world strategies that help you outthink and outmaneuver the status quo.
Last week, my CTO quit on me. I got notification that we had, you know, sort of finished our lab tests. We were successful in getting those two grants. And then I had one of the best energy offtake conversations at the end of the week.
This episode is about the messy, unpredictable, and inspiring reality of building something from nothing. It's about turning research into a roadmap, setbacks into lessons, and discarded batteries into the backbone of our energy future. Settle in. This is a story of grit, vision, and the relentless pursuit of a circular economy. Nick, you are on a mission to build a better energy infrastructure, and you're starting with yesterday's batteries. You're the founder of Mapleview Energy. You're turning Second Life EV batteries into commercial scale energy storage. And you have a long, you know, history and a lot of experience in the circular economy principles. And that's gaining a lot of traction because how we use things and how we reuse things is really, really important. And so we're going to kind of unpack what it really takes to launch a climate tech company from scratch. And what I wanted to begin with is, what was your first idea for Mapleview Energy? And what were those kind of first few steps?
First of all, thanks for having me. Excited to be talking about circular economy today, talking about EV battery repurposing specifically. And I can share that Mapleview Energy is born out of some research I did back when I was doing my master's thesis at Durham University. I was working under a professor named Dr. Sandra Bell, and looking at the EV battery circular economy sort of broadly, looking at reuse, recycling, repurposing. And while doing that, sort of just zeroed in on repurposing and the business model around repurposing, some of the policy infrastructure that would need to exist for businesses to be successful in the space, and sort of just fell in love with the concept, with the business, with the idea of it. When I finished at Durham University, I started working for a company called Minus Global. At the time, Minus was interested in entering the circular economy around EV batteries. So built out some acquisition lists for them and did some like business modeling around, you know, what would it take for them to enter, you know, the circular economy, whether it be in recycling, repurposing, reuse. Now, that was about 6 years ago, and there wasn't a ton of EV batteries around. And I didn't personally really have a lot of background in building businesses from scratch. And so, you know, at the time, Minus was like, yeah, this is really great data, really like cool business model, interesting and stuff like that. But we think it's too early and we're not sure if you're really ready to be doing this.
This is a classic example of right idea, wrong timing. The best climate tech founders often identify opportunities years before markets are ready, then patiently build expertise while waiting for the inflection point. It's not always about being first to market, and it's about being ready when the market finally arrives.
At that time, I started working for one of Minus's portfolio companies, which is Orca, basically an aerobic in situ organic waste digester. And they were like manufacturing this technology. So I started working in operations and sort of the customer service side of that business, contract management, and then started my career in, you know, waste and waste energy, circular economy, these sorts of things. Always wanted to be an entrepreneur. And so when I felt like I had done some business development, done some operations, done some customer service, and had, you know, some experience in these areas, I started reviewing my research into repurposing that I had done, you know, 7 years prior, and started reviewing like those business models and looking around, updating them and refreshing them to see, you know, who had popped up in the space, who had been successful, what sort of strategies had been successful, and decided that, you know what, fuck it, let's go, let's start this business and try to build a company that focuses on repurposing electric vehicle batteries into stationary energy storage for commercial and industrial businesses.
And when you did that research originally, I understand that maybe the sentiment that it was too early, because in order to repurpose batteries, you need batteries to be kind of at their end of life. And I guess in 2019, when you did that research, you know, EVs were selling, but not selling as they've been selling over the past few years. So what did you find in that research? Like, how long does an EV battery typically last in a car, or, you know, and what are we going to see in terms of that research, batteries kind of sitting there being available because they've kind of hit their end of life for what they were doing?
What we're seeing right now is about 15 years, 10 to 15 years before we'll see 20% degradation. These are sort of some average numbers from different research bodies. But, you know, when we're talking about repurposing batteries, we're usually thinking that there's 70, 80% capacity left, right? And so in 2019, the feedstock available because of customer adoption, the number of batteries coming off the roads just really wasn't there. Like, you know, you might get some of those Nissan, like those old Nissan Leaf batteries, some of the very early Tesla batteries if they had been in like a car accident, but you're not going to be able to build a sufficient pipeline of energy storage projects and have the supply of used batteries to fulfill that project pipeline. But what we're seeing now, and these numbers have been floating around quite a bit, especially with like Redwood Materials popping up and entering the energy, you know, the repurposing battery to energy storage market, and Moment Energy having some success out in BC. But the numbers are basically showing that there's going to be like 1,000 gigawatt hours of EV batteries retiring in 2030. And right now, there might be about 2 gigawatt hours of repurposing capacity.
This gap is staggering, and it's the kind of market imbalance that creates massive opportunity. We're looking at a 500x difference between supply and processing capacity. This isn't just a business opportunity, it's an infrastructure necessity. The companies that step in now won't simply win contracts, they'll set the standards for how an entire industry manages its most valuable waste stream.
In 1 year, a facility is popping up to repurpose about a gigawatt hour. So if there's like 1,000, you know, there needs to be 1,000 more gigawatt hours of repurposing capacity by 2030 to actually meet, you know, that sort of circular economy need for EV batteries.
When you say 20%, you mean, you know, let's just take a consumer Nissan Leaf or a Tesla. At what point do they start to recommend a replacement of a battery? Is it when it's degraded 20% roughly?
Yeah, I don't know that many people are really recommending at this point that somebody actually replace their battery. What I've noticed is, you know, a lot of these auto repair shops aren't super well versed with battery replacement yet. And so they're not super well versed with actually testing the batteries and understanding what the state of health is. And so I don't know that like people are really saying, oh yeah, like you should replace the battery once it, you know, there's a 20% degradation and you only have 80% capacity left. I don't know if that's like that conversation's actually happening, but it is being floated around that at the point of 20% degradation, when there's 80% capacity left, when there's 70% capacity left, you're simply, you know, you're not going to get the range out of the battery that you would at 100%. I mean, it's pretty easy to think about, right? But if you're just driving around a town, maybe that, you know, that extra range doesn't really matter. But all of a sudden, if it's a, you know, think about a city bus, right, that has a number of route stops that it's meant to do before it actually goes and refills on gas. Similar thing, it would have a number of route stops it needs to do to operate efficiently before going to charge. And so in those, you know, scenarios, I think like that's really where we're going to see a lot of battery retirement is when the operational efficiency of the battery is required. You know, I think like there's certain use cases, you know, whether it be public transportation or in mining operations where like battery electric vehicles have become, you know, quite an effective way for mining operations to run.
Yeah. We had a commercial boating company too. And I can see that where they're, you know, they're plugging in tugboats and boats every single day, nonstop. And that usage is really, really important. And, you know, as a consumer, just trying to think on the marketing side too, you know, if I had a gas vehicle and 20% of my fuel was basically leaking out it every time I filled it up, I probably wouldn't be super happy at some point. So I'm sure there's going to be like a segment of the market that are going to be like, this is not what I, you know, what I got, especially when there's all this kind of range anxiety. So you took this research, you said, screw this, I'm jumping all in. I'm going to kind of start doing this. What was your idea to pivot this to, okay, well, we can get these EV batteries. There's going to be a flood of these. It's going to be like 1,000 times the amount of available gigawatts available. As you said, 2030, the next kind of five-ish years. How were you thinking about repurposing those? You're not repurposing and then selling them back to another Tesla owner that needs a new battery. You're thinking about battery storage. Why is that kind of the reason you decided to do that?
Yeah, well, for one, with AI electrification, you know, the increased electricity consumption on our grid, we need energy storage, right? We need increased grid capacity. We need to be able to have a reliant grid for operational efficiencies with other sorts of businesses. And so, you know, the one way to do this and one way to have backup power, one way to increase grid operational reliability is to have energy storage. And for energy storage, there's a number of, you know, ways that we can actually, you know, build out batteries for that or other sorts of, you know, energy efficiency technologies. But by repurposing electric vehicle batteries and using those lithium ion batteries specifically for energy storage or LFP batteries for energy storage, NMC, so on and so forth, all these different chemistries for that energy storage scenario, you're able to reduce the cost of energy storage and create more adoption or more economically efficient adoption for a number of different players across, like, you know, grid service utilization. But the one area that I've focused specifically on is the commercial industrial space. I think that, you know, with households, right, is if we see more EV adoption, we're going to have a lot of vehicle to grid capabilities or like bi-directional charging capabilities. And so a lot of households will have energy storage, but, you know, with, you know, a high rise facility or a manufacturing facility in Southern Ontario, you know, having, you know, that stationary energy storage system will provide them like the backup power or that operational reliability, but then also provide them some other grid services like peak shaving. And, you know, I think like what everybody is seeing, right, is that our electricity costs are going to continue to increase as we use more electricity. And, you know, by being able to do some, you know, peak shaving and cutting the demand charge, there's, you know, a really good ROI for adopting energy storage.
This market selection is more strategic than it might appear. Commercial customers have predictable energy patterns, they have larger installations, which mean better unit economics, and they're more sophisticated, typically, which means that they understand the return on investment beyond just power backup. What Nick's doing is avoiding the consumer education challenge that plagues so many hardware startups.
You know, there's, I suppose, a number of reasons why energy storage is necessary and increased grid capacity is necessary. But I think that, you know, the big thing here is actually using existing resources to meet that need, meet that capacity, the required capacity, and doing it in the most economically, environmentally efficient way is really like what I'm interested in, but what, like, I also just believe is like the right thing to do for our society.
Yeah, you're using a waste stream that's not really wasteful, repackaging it in an efficient way. So, like, to just kind of paint the picture of what this looks like, and I say potentially because I know you're a startup and you're in this early stage right now. Is this kind of like a Tesla Powerwall for your house on steroids that ends up being, you know, a lot larger, used in the commercial settings? Like, what is this all packaged into, like, a massive sea container? Like,
yeah. It depends a bit on the size of the system required by the customer. But yeah, you know, it could be a shipping container or a couple shipping containers for, you know, a really large energy user. It could be more similar to a Powerwall, or, you know, there could be a smaller sort of housing for a smaller energy user. But that is sort of, yeah, if you're going to paint the picture, right? Like, what you're doing really from like a component side is getting battery modules and rewiring them with other battery modules or battery packs, including some power electronics, a battery management system, an energy management system, a thermal management system, and then housing them in a way that would protect them from whatever environment they're actually going to be utilized in.
Yeah. So you have a name, you have an idea, you have research, we have the market that's kind of, we know is going to be flooded with a lot of batteries available to be repurposed. What was your kind of next steps? Did you go to accelerators? Did you start raising money? Did you go to family and friends? Like, what was your kind of next step to get the business started?
So first of all, I was living downtown Toronto when I decided that I was going to take the leap. So I moved back home with my parents to Collingwood, Ontario, and sort of cut some of my own operating costs before going out into the world without a salary, benefits, and all of those good things that come with having, you know, a stable income.
You created yourself your own kind of runway, essentially?
Yes, that's exactly what I did. You know, I had some savings. I moved home, and then I entered the Georgian Bay Accelerator and entered at the point of ideation. So the Georgian Bay Accelerator has, they worked with like a company called Impossible Metals, focused on deep sea mining robotics. And so they've had like some interesting hardware companies go through, relatively small accelerator, but the executive director, Peter Henke, he's been around startups for long time now and has had some success. And so I went through ideation, you know, with him and with that accelerator, like sort of just built out like lean canvas models, did some additional research on like the business modeling, started to sort of assess the business model, if you will, like, you know, finding different players upstream, downstream, and having conversations with them about what's actually going on in the world. So developing, you know, some stakeholder relationships and testing some theories, really. From there, I was accepted into Brilliant Ventures Mobility Accelerator, which is out of Ontario Technical University. And so now that I had done, you know, the ideation, you know, so I had the research, I had a little bit of runway, had some ideation going, I then went into this mobility accelerator to sort of design an MVP, if you will. And to do that, worked with some engineers out of Ontario Tech and sort of said like, hey, if we were going to, you know, build this tomorrow, what would it look like? And why would it look like that? So, you know, what sort of features of this, you know, prototype would be needed to have an MVP? or a minimum viable product that could, you know, could service a customer. So did that. And then I was in January of this year, worked with Ontario Tech, the students and a professor there, Dr. Sheldon Williamson, to design, you know, a contract around that MVP or that prototype development. And so we designed that contract in, signed the contract in March, and then began building. And so we are just about finished building that product. And in the meantime, I went through another accelerator or incubator, the Antler Entrepreneur in Residence Incubator. And in the meantime, sort of started like knocking off the technology readiness level strategy that we've devised. And, you know, this first prototype will be, you know, right now we're doing like lab testing at Ontario Tech. And then we have a contract under Ontario Center of Innovation Technology Access Program for Critical Industrial Technologies to go in and pilot the prototype. So right now we're at like technology readiness level 4. Once we're finished with the OCI contract in a few months, we'll be at technology readiness level 5. And then we'll, you know, continue to the point of being at technology readiness level 9, at which point we're at commercialization and sort of have the proper, you know, hardware certifications ready to go to market.
And with this accelerator programs, because you've done a few now, and the one that you're in right now, do they help with that pilot and that commercialization test, as in like they're helping you build it, they're testing it into the lab, but do they have a commercial partner that is willing to test this in a commercial setting? That's kind of part of the accelerator program too?
So that, you know, the commercial testing and commercial setting will be, you know, will need to be around 6-7. And so what I'm doing right now is working with a number of different companies and analyzing their energy data to see if, you know, utilizing a repurposed electric vehicle batteries to create an energy storage system, the economics basically makes sense to go and do a, you know, a commercial scale sort of demonstration at one of, you know, their facilities. And I've looked at a mining site so far, looked at the, you know, there's a company that does a lot of commercial builds across the province here, and have looked at a couple of those commercial builds, like new build type energy data, and modeled it out. And so as we like, you know, it's sort of this chicken or the egg, as you know, you get closer to the point of having the technology be at the point of commercialization, that's when you can sort of have more conversations about what does that commercialization really look like. And, you know, at this point, sort of using energy data to do what I would call design partnerships. And then in the same breath, you know, furthering that technology readiness level strategy.
This approach is exactly what separates successful hardware founders from the rest. While software can launch with an MVP and iterate, hardware requires a different discipline. You need to validate both the technology and the business case before you can scale. If you're building physical climate solutions, this technology readiness framework isn't just helpful, it's essential for business survival.
When, you know, one of these design partnerships turns into, you know, let's do a pilot demonstration, we'll be ready to go.
Yeah, it's interesting because you're utilizing technology that's like battery you would consider hardware. You're packaging this up, making this potentially available for commercial. But alongside this, you know, I keep thinking about how do you go to market, right? And you're obviously thinking about it. You need to get to a, you know, a technology level 9 or 6 and, you know, testing and then full out commercialization. But like, what do you think is critical success? So like, if you're thinking about a pitch deck and you're trying to raise a bunch of money to go into kind of commercial, like what's critical success? Is it going into a mining company with a product that's like, listen, this is going to save you 25% versus the other options? What is that at the other end that then kind of unlocks that potential investment to say, yes, we'll start? Because you like you said, you got to build first and then sales after. But, you know, trying to get to a point where, you know, these are these critical success points that allow you then to get into the commercialization. Like you said, it's a bit of a chicken and egg.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have built out a model for post like pilot simulation. So it's like, you know, doing a pilot in a simulated environment. So once we finish that and we're at that technology readiness level 5 point, I think that in theory we are, you know, could go the route of doing a pre-seed raise. And, you know, at that time, there's a number of different venture capital firms that I've been talking to that I will approach for, you know, the purpose of fundraising and helping us get to the next level. But I do think that there are other creative ways to find partners that could, you know, could support the technology readiness level from getting that from that like 5, 6 to 9, and could be like really great partners for the offtake side of this business. The ones that would actually be have a number of assets, for example, to use the energy storage system and also have experience in the energy markets. You know, I think that these are things that I'm constantly thinking about and working through and having conversations about, but it has a defined pathway come to fruition where by which I'm able to say, yes, this is 100% the way forward. No, not yet. But am I closer? Do I feel closer all the time? Do I feel a lot closer than I did a year and 3 months ago when I started the company? Yeah, 100%.
But. Yeah, I bring it up because I think a lot of people when they're starting a business need to hear this, because these are the thing that entrepreneurs often have to do is they often have to be focused on technology, focused on this is what we want to achieve. In the same time, they're also in the back of their mind realizing that, hey, nobody's actually paid us for anything. We need to get to some sort of critical success for them in order to do that. And we hope that they're going to be buying on the other end. And so the idea there is you need to bridge that gap that your hope becomes obviously realized. And I guess in this scenario, what the unique thing could be is that your partners could also be like these people testing it could also be paying you as well to help you kind of get that, because there is money there that could be kind of exchanged to help you bridge a bit of that gap. But, you know, it's that's the hard part of raising venture as well and doing that. So,
and for the benefit of, I suppose, the listeners that are really interested in entrepreneurship, I can say that last week, my CTO quit on me. I got notification that we had, you know, sort of finished our lab tests. So now we're at TRL4, ready to enter, you know, into like the next phase of our technology readiness level strategy with the OCI, Critical Industrial Technologies Technology Access Program. I unlocked 2 grants, like we were successful in getting those 2 grants. And then I had one of the best energy offtake conversations at the end of the week.
This roller coaster is the entrepreneurial reality that doesn't make it into pitch decks. The strongest founders I know don't really experience fewer setbacks. They just process them faster and extract the lessons without getting derailed. That resilience isn't just a personal quality, it becomes embedded in the company's DNA and operational approach.
So it was just like, you know, one of these, we're going up hard down, like a lot of uncertainty and then some back up again. And that's, you know, in my experience so far with entrepreneurship, it's really, I think there's like that Rudyard Kipling poem where it's like, if you can keep your head when all else around you are losing theirs, that's like, I think one little part of the poem that is something that I am learning to exercise, you know, in the best possible ways.
It is a roller coaster ride. And my understanding, you are the sole founder. Like, you obviously have team members, but you are the sole founder. So you have to ride that roller coaster mentally a bit by yourself versus having a partner to, you know, be happy on some things and sad on the other things and annoyed by the other things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think my girlfriend's getting, you know, she went to school for psychology and she works in like for an AI company doing partnerships now. But she's using that psychology degree for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. When you talk about modeling as well, like how much does AI play into that modeling that can give you a little bit more assurances as you kind of take that next step to market?
I would say that I don't use AI a ton for the modeling piece. I use it, you know, when I'm doing some marketing activities, I'm trying to do some writing, trying to think through some different ideas, doing some research, like the deep research functions. But I don't really use it for economic modeling. I suppose the number one reason for that is that I want to understand intimately the inputs and outputs of the business and not rely on AI for that, especially at this early stage. And my dad was an entrepreneur, and I swear, like, that guy has a book for every business he owned, and that book has every like dollar into it and every dollar out of it. And he knew, you know, the unit economics on, you know, everything. And so I feel very strongly that I need to be in the same headspace right now. So I don't use it for modeling, but I use it for a lot of other things for sure.
Yeah. And speaking about the other things, like at this stage, how do you do pre-sales and how do you do pre-marketing and pre-branding to have that also? Like, you don't really want to go quiet completely. So how do you do those things and what are you focusing on right now? Are you trying to build out your lead profiles of potential customers in the future to get as much feedback? Are you trying to get yourself marketed so that, you know, people understand who MapleView is? And as you start getting through these tests, it makes it a lot easier. Or are you really mostly focused on money, grants, funding, venture, that type of thing?
All of the above. But, you know, in terms of being able to sort of find or build a project pipeline, so I come from the world of waste energy, right? And in, you know, waste energy, you're looking at like large waste contracts and large energy contracts for the purpose of de-risking the industrial build out of that waste energy infrastructure. And those contracts, they're big contracts, right? And they take a long, you know, they're long sales cycles. And so I'm using my mentor at my previous company, Chris Gillen, you know, founder of Stormfisher, Stormfisher Waste Energy, and then Stormfisher Hydrogen. You know, I'm using a lot of the principles that he taught me and having those, you know, those long sales cycles and like the, you know, the big contract development. And that's really just taking things slowly, you know, introducing yourself first, you know, learning about the other team, learning about their pain points, you know, taking this consultative approach, you know, signing an NDA, getting some energy data, modeling out the energy data, building a report, you know, going and presenting the report. You know, these things take time. You can't really do that overnight, right? You can't try to sell an app or a widget to somebody in the same way, right? That is, you know, my strategy right now, especially as I, you know, I don't have a big facility, a gigawatt hour facility where I can repurpose a ton of batteries into energy storage and have a number of offtake and number of projects just going. But, you know, slowly building to that point and sort of nursing the relationships is, you know, the way forward at the moment.
You obviously are pre-revenue. And so kind of a question around customers spending money in this area. So if everything worked out, and let's talk about 3 to 5 years, like what size of market is this? Is this a place where a lot of money is being spent right now in battery storage, and are customers currently spending money, and is that it projected to increase? And I guess, how do you want to see MapleView over the next kind of 3 to 5 years with that kind of spending?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of movement in energy storage right now. And I think like the CAGR is like 21.5% over the next 10 years. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of spending in the space. I reposted this recently, but somebody had posted about, you know, Warren Buffett's naming his successor, and his successor really comes from the energy space. And, you know, what people are thinking about that or theorizing is that there's such a need to upgrade the grid. There's such a need for increased grid capacity, but also increase energy production. And because of that, you know, his successor is going to be somebody that, you know, comes from the energy space, comes from financing energy projects and big infrastructure projects, right? And so I think that there's just a huge market on energy. It's almost like, you know, it's almost like water at this point. It's like we can't live without it. I don't think too much about like, you know, a TAM, SAM, SOM. I do think like there is more strategic ways to enter the market than other ways. And, you know, back to my previous point about, you know, what am I sort of focus on in building a client base is, you know, sort of taking things slow to understand what the, you know, economic use case is of a few different players, whether those be, you know, hospitals, data centers, mining sites, you know, sort of some of these critical infrastructure pieces, and understanding what the economic use case is in these. And in doing so, developing the relationships with these sorts of players so that when ready to, you know, go full steam ahead and enter the market, we have a, you know, a lot of strategic data in place for the reasons to do that. And I think like today, I don't know for sure. I know that when we've looked at the economic use case with a mining site, things look really promising. I know that when we looked at it with a data center, things looked like really promising. And so it's sort of hard to say like, yeah, this is for sure the one, but it, you know, I think that the clarity will come if I continue to put myself out there, continue to look at energy data, continue to network and build relationships.
What Mapleview Energy is building isn't just about batteries. It's about turning waste into infrastructure and a moment when our grid urgently needs solutions. By taking EV batteries with a 70 to 80% capacity left and transforming them into commercial energy storage, Nick is creating where others see only depreciation. It's a model that meets both environmental imperatives and economic realities. The path from research to commercialization is never really straight. It's built on pivots, persistence, and the ability to, as Nick puts it, keep your head when all around you are losing theirs. This is the kind of climate tech we need. Solutions that don't just chase tomorrow's problems, but use today's resources in smarter, more circular ways. Thanks for listening to The Capitalist Hippie. This episode sparks something for you, share it with someone who's rethinking what business can be, and let's build something better together.